Well, welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison tonight. I want to recognize a couple of different groups that coordinated pulling this together and then introduce Sean, our speaker. My name is John Rummel, and I am one of the founders of the Madison Skeptics, who is partially responsible for this particular gathering tonight. Jennifer Bunner is the co-founder of the Madison Skeptics. The Madison Skeptics were just another group in Madison of you know, godless, heathen, heretic, but very patriotic unbelievers. We have a meeting next Sunday, September 20th. We're sort of back to our regular kind of, you know, geeky schedule of having scientist-type speakers. And we have a speaker from the university, Dr. James Conway, who's going to speak about vaccination and immunology in general. So kind of a timely thing with H1N1 coming back around and a lot of other vaccination craziness that you may have heard about in the news in the last couple of years. So that's next Sunday, Middleton Library, 2 p.m. Check out the websites for information on that. Also responsible for tonight's get-together, Bob Park and the Madison Humanist, the Humanist Union of Madison, and Bob makes this facility available to us. Any announcements from you guys?
Right, I'll just mention that our next meeting is Sunday, October 4th, and we'll be having Ron Solomon, who's on the board of the American Ethical Union, talking to us about the membership of the Ethical Union in the Secular Coalition for America and how it fits into the goals of ethical humanism today to be an active part of that organization. Ron has also been involved with previous meetings here when he has been leading a study group on ethical humanism. So you're all welcome to come to this meeting house at noon on October 4th.
Also here today, Julie Starczewski, Leslie Starczewski. I got your last name correct and screwed up the first one. Madison Brights. Any announcements from you guys?
Oh, no, just check us out on the website, Facebook. We have our projects listed on there.
And the real Julie, Julie Merrill Quinn of the Madison Doubters.
Yeah, well, it's the First Unitarian Society.
Okay.
Kind of on hiatus right now. We've been around for about 6 years and are not real active. So we are, with all the other groups, you can kind of find some place to land. And one announcement I wanted to make is that we're starting to plan our Human Light Celebration, which is going to be December 23rd at Prairie. So that should be a fun potluck dinner, kind of an alternative to all the other Christmas-type celebrations. And looking forward to seeing a lot of the people that are here tonight.
And we get
December 23rd, it'll be a Wednesday.
Do we have a tentative planning,
yes,
like the 20th, sometime during that weekend?
Yeah, it's the 20th. Meeting right before your meeting.
Great. Okay. I think we've covered everybody that sort of came together to help get this together for tonight. So let's introduce Sean Fairclough. Sean is the executive director of the Secular Coalition for America. So if you are a secular humanist, if you're a non-believer, if you're an atheist, if you're an agnostic, and if you care about national issues that have a relationship to issues of belief or non-belief, and in the last administration, there were a lot of issues. So I think a lot of that is fairly close to many of our hearts. Sean represents us in Washington, D.C. to our elected leaders. He lobbies. He works with another lobbyist, and the Secular Coalition does a lot of good work in the interests of the non-believers, the secular humanists, the people who have contrarian views to the theist majority. So, without further ado, I'm going to let Sean say a few words about himself, but let's welcome him to Madison.
Thank you, John, thank you all the different groups who helped to put this together, and Leslie and Bob and Julie, hope to say hello more. I know it's a lot of work putting these kinds of events together with the additional obligations that you have. So thanks a whole lot for doing that. And I did get a chance to go up to Bobfest briefly today. Great. I'm an American history buff, so I really like fighting Bob La Follette, and feel like everything about America in some ways can be embodied by sort of the yin and yang of Wisconsin politicians, fighting Bob La Follette on one end and Joseph R. McCarthy on the other. They really do kind of embody, I hope, a lot of the things that we work for in Secular Coalition for America, I think are things that fighting Bob La Follette would approve of, including something called the First Amendment. Sadly, Joseph R. McCarthy was a very big part of American history in the 1950s, an incredibly oppressive time for a lot of Americans and a lot of minority views. It was the time when the phrase "one nation under God" was instituted into American law. And it was the seed of a lot of things that were more ominous over succeeding decades. And so in some ways, Wisconsin embodies a big part of the struggle that is America, and that I feel is part of the struggle of what Secular Coalition for America is all about. And with our coalition, one of the things that I'm most proud about, and I know it's hard to do, I served 10 years in the Maine legislature, I was the majority whip of the Maine legislature in my last term, is it's hard to get people to work together. When you're whip, that's your job all the time, right? It's just, come on, team, let's work together. And that I do think it's important and necessary that all groups of people who are humanists or atheists or non-theists work collaboratively together, not necessarily agree on every philosophical point, but I hope when it comes to public policy issues that we almost all do agree 100%, and we need to stay united for those purposes. So that's really the mission that we have as an organization in terms of public policy, and then helping to raise our profile around the country. And I'm different than sometimes a lot of the speakers because I'm just a lawyer, politician. I'm not a scientist or a biblical scholar. But I did want to start with one Bible story that affected me. When I was a kid traveling across the country, in fact, I'm not sure where it was, somewhere in the Midwest, I think, actually. Even though I was in Maine for my adult life, I grew up in California. My parents were teachers and traveled a lot. I remember one time I said, all right, you know, 11, 12.
Is that why you don't have an accent?
You know, nobody in Maine has an accent really anymore. After born after 1960, 65, the accent thing went. But in that time, somewhere, 11, 12 years old, I said, I'm going to read that children's Bible, you know. And I read the whole thing, and I remember one part that really struck me was when God tells Abraham to kill his son, right? And my dad's driving the car, I'm in the back, you know, fighting with my sister, and I'm thinking, I hope my dad's not too God-fearing of a guy, because that seems kind of ominous from my perspective. Here's the son in the back seat of the car. But then I started to have some of my own thoughts that I was glad to see years later that Bob Dylan had in the song Highway 61 Revisited. But would it be moral for a God to direct someone to kill their child? And secondly, would it be moral for a father to obey a command from a God or anyone to kill their child? And then a third thing that's not raised as much is, would it be moral to think of children as some form of property, some form of chattel that you own and can sacrifice at your will? Because I was under the impression that children are human beings and that they have rights like other people. So that context of that Bible story relates for me to some of the public policy that I want to talk to you about, not in an ancient story, but a fact, an event that happened in real life with reporters and people who investigated in this century. There was a girl named Amia White. And Amia White attended a child care, as most children in America do. And Amia White was alone in a van. Somehow the child care staff had lost track of her. And it was in Alabama. It was hot. and she got cooked in 2 hours in the van. Her two-year-old heart gave out, and she died in that van. Outside of the van, painted on the side of the van, were the words, Holy Church. And the reason those words are painted is because it was a religious child care. And in Alabama, religious child cares are exempt from child staff ratio laws that apply to secular child cares. Now picture two child cares right side by side in the state of Alabama. Child care number one is secular, your typical child care. Child care number two is a religious child care. Under Alabama law, there's medication safety regulations. You don't want Joey's medications mixed up with Susie's medications, and there's rules about these things. Those laws don't apply to religious child cares. The child staff ratio laws don't apply to religious child cares. Food safety laws do not apply to religious child cares. The secular child cares are subject to unannounced state inspections. Not religious child cares, no inspections. Forget about unannounced ones. They don't have any inspections. IRS financial statements must be filed by the secular child care, not by religious child cares. But listen, you guys should not worry, because the president of the Christian Coalition of Alabama said, you know, the pastors and the congregations are our quality control. So you're all set there. But to be fair, perhaps it was an anomaly. It's one death, and one hopes that it's an anomaly. Unfortunately, there was a boy named Demyron Lindley, and Demyron was 3 years old, I believe. And in his case, in Alabama, in a religious child care, he was left alone in a van for 10 hours. And Demyron died alone. Think about what it would be like for a little boy alone in a van, can't get out in the heat. 10 hours and then you die. That was the end of his life. These deaths are rare. One is too many. But even in religious child cares, these deaths are rare. But the neglect is much, much more common. And there's studies about this. Children left alone in their own feces for hours because they don't have sufficient child staff ratios, because they don't need to obey the law. They are exempted by the legislature from the law of that state on these issues. And remember also that this is your tax money. And I'm saying you Wisconsin residents, your tax money. Because 25% of the children in the religious child cares, the ones that don't need to obey the law, receive the federal low-income subsidy. So your tax money goes to these types of facilities and to their profits that you can't see or understand because they don't file IRS financial statements. You don't know what's happening in those types of facilities. I served 10 years in the Maine legislature, and we're not a state dominated by the religious right, not by any means. But even in Maine, they had these kinds of exemptions where they'd say, for example, this is an example from Maine, they'd say, in a small child care, if the parent says they have religious objections, they can exempt the child from getting vaccinations, even though that endangers that child, but also other children in the community as well. And that's in a state like Maine that actually is much more progressive on these kinds of issues. So there's about 15 states, though, that have the broad kind of exemptions that I've just described in the state of Alabama. I want to go back. I mentioned the ancient story about Abraham. I want to talk about another story, but this one is historically more verifiable. The Incas, about 500 years ago. The Incas had a ceremony. They would take the children up to the mountains. They would drug them. And then they would kill them as a sacrifice to their gods. That was their tradition. But remember what I said, they would drug them to anesthetize them, basically, and they killed them pretty quickly. Contrast that with Madeline Newman in the state of Wisconsin last year. Contrast the experience in this century for that child. When you have type 1 diabetes, as Madeline had, it's not just killing her. It's torturing her. With that type 1 diabetes for a little 11-year-old girl here in the state of Wisconsin, she goes through incredible, desperate, agonizing thirst. Then she starts to throw up. Then she's sweating profusely. Then she's back to thirst and eyes rolling back in her head. Think about if you have a child or a niece or a nephew, a little child that you know and you care about. Think about that for 10 minutes. Think about watching a child go through that for 10 minutes. Then think about that child going through that for a month and then dying. That wasn't just killing that child. The Incas drugged him and killed him. Here in Wisconsin, in this century, they tortured her, and then they killed her. That's what happened in this century. These kinds of situations are sadly more common than you might expect. In Tennessee, there was a girl, Jessica Crank. She had a tumor on her shoulder, totally treatable, just like everything was treatable for the girl here in Wisconsin. The mother in Tennessee pointed, and this is in just in this century, pointed to the Epistle of James. That's my medicine, the Epistle of James. The tumor continued to grow. It was painful. For this 15-year-old Jessica Crank, the tumor grotesquely grew to the size of a basketball on her shoulder. Then she died after agonizing pain. See, these politicians in the legislatures care more about lobbying from religious groups than they do about science, and more than they do about the lives of these children who are dying. Hundreds of them have died. They did a study of the Faith Assembly congregation. A lot of times you think of the Christian Scientists with this issue of the so-called faith healing, which, by the way, I object to. If it were faith healing, I'd be for it. It's faith killing. It is child sacrifice, just meaner than the Incas did it, more harsh than the Incas did it. So whenever you hear that, when you see it in the paper, when they talk about that case, because they're going to sentence the father in that case soon, they're going to say, oh, the faith healing case. Write a letter to the editor and say, that's not faith healing. That's faith killing, and that's child sacrifice, and it's an abomination against any basic morality in Wisconsin or any place else. So they did a study of the Faith Assembly congregation, which is another one of these so-called faith healing organizations, and they studied children birth to 6 months. We're talking little infants. And they did a clinical study of them in a control group versus, you know, people who did not engage in that. A 270% infant mortality rate higher than the control population of children. We're not even hearing about the number of kids who die from this horrible kind of treatment for children in this society. And a question comes to mind for me is, where were those right to life groups on this issue? Every life is sacred, every sperm is sacred, as they say in the Monty Python. Well, if every sperm is sacred and every life is sacred, then maybe these children's lives are also sacred. But a question also is for us, where were we? Why aren't we pounding on the door of every state legislator and saying, this is a moral abomination, let us do what is right? You know, Senator Grassley over in Iowa, do you remember a couple weeks ago, he was talking about the death panels. These are death panels with, at a maximum, two members. They get to kill another human being, and it's a decision of one or two at a maximum. It's really an abomination. So there's two examples that are a little bit less frequently known, maybe known more here in Wisconsin because of the tragedy recently, but the child care situation and the child sacrifice situation. Another one that's more popularly discussed is the issue of child sexual abuse. And I went to the University of Notre Dame. Know lots of priests, like priests, have nothing against priests, and do not claim that priests are the sole basis for child sexual abuse. It's not fair to say that. But here's the institutional difference and problem that is fair to bring up. I'll give you an example. Father Paul Shanley, some of you may have heard of Father Shanley. Father Shanley was a member and attended the Man-Boy Love Association meetings. He went to the meetings. Now, he went to the meetings, but here's the part that's significant. His boss, Bishop Daly, knew that he was attending the Man-Boy Love Association meetings. I've been an executive director of other nonprofits before I worked here. If I had some employee in my 501c3 nonprofit that's accused of sexual abuse, they're going to depose me. They're going to ask for all my paperwork and information about my employment decisions regarding that person, and I'm going to have to turn them over, as I should, of course. The Catholic Church says that it is their free expression right under the First Amendment to keep secret their internal decisions about their employees. And think about the context. Back in my hometown of Bangor, Maine, right now, because we're having a recall initiative on gay marriage, of the many moral issues that the church could discuss, they have selected one, gay marriage. And they are handing out flyers in Bangor, Maine, from the Catholic Church to the parishioners to oppose gay marriage. Think about how a system of government, and really the church acts like a system of government or a large business, how you can simultaneously make the policy decision, we're against gay marriage and actively opposing it, and by the way, we're going to keep secret that we're moving pedophiles from parish A to parish B and keep all the records of those employees secret. How can you think those two things at the same time? But that is, in fact, what happened. And I want to point out, because you'll hear this, and in fact, I read it in one of your Wisconsin papers yesterday when they were talking about the case of Madeline. They said, well, you know, there's a lot of issues about freedom of religion, and I want to say, as Secular Coalition, I absolutely believe in the complete enforcement of the First Amendment, not just the Establishment Clause saying there should be no establishment of religion. I completely support anyone's free expression of their religion. Absolutely. That's the First Amendment. But they're wrong. And sorry, the Wisconsin editorial page that I read was wrong. If there was a right to kill your child, we'd know about it. But in fact, there isn't. Prince versus Massachusetts was a 1943 United States Supreme Court case. It held, there is no right, quote, to expose the community or the child to communicable diseases or the latter to ill health or death. There's no right with any of these issues. There's no constitutional right here whatsoever. Duh, excuse me. That's why they're going to the legislature. If there was a right, they wouldn't need to go to the legislature. They're going to the legislature because they can get the politicians to pass the statute. If it was a right, they could just go to court and see it enforced. It's a flimflam. Don't let the editorial pages flimflam you. Don't let anyone else, don't elect elected officials say this is at stake. It is not a religious free expression issue, but you'll hear that as I read it in one of the Wisconsin papers time and again. What it is, though, what it really is, though, is a life and death issue. This is a life and death issue that also has to do with the separation of church and state, but it involves the death of a number of people that we should be speaking out on behalf of. How do we get here? John Witt, who's a law professor at Emory University, the Center for Study of Church and State, says the separation of church and state is, quote, no longer the law of the land. And he has a point. The religious right, for so many years now, has been telling us, ooh, beware. Beware of special rights, usually for gay people. Sometimes it's African Americans with affirmative action, but beware of special rights, a term that they created and used and marketed. But you know what special rights are? Special rights are not treating people equally regarding marriage. Special rights are elevating one class of people over another class of people on the basis of religion. And these examples I have given you are exactly that. It's an unfortunate situation in our constitutional form of government, and we need to work together to do something about it. And it's a passion for me since I was a kid. When I was in high school, you know, everybody always talks about how they got into being an agnostic or an atheist, whatever the case may be. For me, I tried out for the high school play, and the play was Inherit the Wind. You guys know that one? About the Scopes Monkey Trials? And I really worked hard, and I memorized my lines and got ready. And I got the lead. I got to play the Clarence Darrow part. And you know, you memorize those lines. You memorize what Clarence Darrow is saying in that trial, and you go, "Hmm, that's pretty persuasive. You know, he's got some points to make there." Hmm. You know, and you start to absorb these things as a 15 or 16-year-old kid. But one of the interesting things about that play, if you go back and watch it again in the movie or what have you, is that it was written in the mid-20th century. And the whole tone of the play, looking back on the 1920s Scopes Monkey Trials, is, you know, those were those bad old days. Back in the 20s, we are moving to the higher ground of separation of church and state. Things are looking good. And they have it's infused with this optimism. So you have to wonder what happened to our society in recent decades that didn't turn out the way those church-state separationists who wrote that play thought it was going to be. Now, bear in mind, churches have always been powerful. They were certainly powerful in the mid-20th century, no doubt about it. But things are somewhat different. In the mid-20th century, with most churches, it was the church, and maybe there was a soup kitchen, or they'd engage in some sometimes, you know, valuable charitable activities. And I'm not saying there weren't some very bad things that churches did in those days, but things started to really change and then accelerated with the Reagan era. Because especially with fundamentalist churches, to their credit, if you want to put it this way, they became enterprises. They're Walmart forms of churches, where literally, these examples are real, they own ice cream parlors, fitness centers, addiction treatment centers, broadcasting significantly, and major lobbying enterprises. What you've seen arise over the last 20 to 30 years is effectively an almost unregulated separate business universe with these kinds of churches. And so we really need to look differently at what the nature of these institutions really are. And one context that I like to think about is affirmative action. You know, if you listen to right-wing talk radio, I was on right-wing talk radio day before yesterday in Des Moines, Iowa, and you hear the talk, oh, affirmative action. Affirmative action is bad. Rush Limbaugh will tell you, right? Affirmative action was bad, usually in relation to African Americans. And for me, Secular Coalition doesn't take a position. That's not one of our issues, and we don't, as an organization, take a position on affirmative action. But I think you got to concede, whether you agree or disagree with affirmative action, that the centuries of slavery and many decades of civil rights violations is at least a decent argument for affirmative action, or as they might term it, special rights. But special rights for Billy Graham? Billy Graham, when they recently released the Nixon tapes, and Billy Graham said to Nixon, "Watch out for those synagogues of Satan," that's a quote. What Billy Graham, during the Vietnam War, said, and I'm quoting, that Jesus came to send fire on the earth, that Jesus was brought not to send peace, but a sword. This is what the kind of thing he was saying at the height of the Vietnam War with his huge multi-million dollar organization even then. Billy Graham gets special rights?
Yeah.
Yes, he does. Rick Warren, who spoke at the inaugural, right? Rick Warren, who compared Terry Schiavo's husband to a Nazi, who, after he gives away all his charitable money, because he makes a big deal about how much money Rick Warren gives away to charity, he's worth almost $10 million. He's a preacher. He's worth almost $10 million. That Rick Warren and his multi-million dollar organization, they get special rights? Yes. Yes, they do under American law. Ted Haggard's another one of my favorite examples. Ted Haggard, you know, preaching against the gay sex while having gay sex on meth. Woo! But, you know, the gay sex on meth kind of overshadowed another even more important part, is that those other two, they don't have as much money. His organization in Colorado Springs, he doesn't have the same control, but that organization still exists. And that is one of the most powerful, funded organizations and politically effective organizations in the United States. And they live on unabated by any sex scandal. They're doing very well. And do they get special rights? Yes. Yes, they do. They have huge power in our society. One of the powers I think we almost don't even think about, in those jurisdictions, like Maine, we have an anti-discrimination law. We just passed a law legalizing gay marriage. But even in Maine and in many states that are anti-discrimination, these organizations have an exception. So they're authorized by law, and they can say things like, "You're a Jew, you're fired." It's legal. It's legal to do that. "You're gay, you're fired. You're agnostic, like Albert Einstein, you're fired. You're atheist, like Mark Twain, you're fired." They've prettied up, they call it co-religionists. But what the effect is they can do those things and do them with the authorization of law. Another one that a lot of people aren't aware of is that these same mega businesses, the Walmart churches, they have a federal law that passed in 1999 that allows them to exempt themselves from many of the land use regulation laws that a typical business has to pass. I always want to talk to my friends, you know, who are Republicans, and we're a nonpartisan organization, say, "Hey, you know, you're for capitalism, free enterprise. Why don't they have to obey the same laws that your business has to obey?" They don't. They don't have to obey those land use regulations. So today, in this decade, more than ever, we need an organization like Secular Coalition for America and our 10-member organizations to stand up against this real change in the separation of church and state in our society, because we haven't been doing a very good job. You know, when people who are good-hearted and I'm talking about religious people too, good-hearted religious people, good-hearted non-religious people, when we sit back and don't get active, that's when these kinds of laws pass. It's also when politicians are afraid to think independently that things go as badly as they have. And in that respect, I want to do a little mind experiment, a little exercise with you, where we all pretend that we are political consultants. And we're going to have our candidate come in and we're going to think through things with our client who's thinking about a run for public office. And we dig out, you know, because you do opposition research. One of the first things you do when you got a candidate that you want to help is you do opposition research on your own candidate. So we dug out some quotes from our candidate. And here's one. Quote number one. The clergy dreads the advance of science as witches do the approach of daylight. Quote two. Religions are all alike, founded on fables and mythologies. Quote number three. Christianity is our particular superstition. So, those three quotes for our candidate, we're the consultants. In the real world, what are we going to advise our candidate? Well, I can tell you, after 10 years in elective office, helping candidates, I'm going to say, hang it up, kid. And then I'll say, that'll be $5,000 for the consulting fee. Sorry, candidate Thomas Jefferson. Maybe accounting is a better career for you, Mr. Jefferson. Candidate Thomas Jefferson, who many believe was the smartest president ever, one of the greatest presidents ever, and the author of the Declaration of Independence, we would probably lose as a candidate for Congress today because he dared to think independently.
Well, he was a Unitarian.
Right. Well, who knows what he was. But whatever he was someone who, the guy, Thomas Jefferson, with the powdered wig, 1700s, his problem would be today that he's more modern in his thinking than much of the political society that we're in today. And why is that? Well, part of the founding, or a significant turning point in this, was in 1984, when it was okay at the Republican convention, before millions of Americans watching on TV, before the huge hall, when the minister brought everyone together for the beginning of the Republican convention, he said, and I quote, "There is no such thing as the separation of church and state. It is merely a figment of the imagination of infidels." Infidels, I'm assuming, like Thomas Jefferson, who wrote that phrase, separation of church and state. Now consider another quote. "In no instance have the churches been guardians of the liberties of the people." James Madison, father of the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson, you see, he said separation of church and state. That was his phrase. James Madison said total separation of church and state. Recently, just to give you a sense of where James Madison was coming from, recently some of us were kind of pleased because President Obama made less of a big deal of the National Prayer Breakfast than did his predecessor. James Madison opposed the existence of National Prayer Days, said so publicly. Secular Coalition for America, we are out there lobbying on your behalf to say there should be no proselytizing by military chaplains, okay? James Madison opposed the existence of military chaplains. He said it would become majority tyranny by its nature. He was against it, period. This guy really, he took a different view, let's say, than what you might see as popular today. Another one, we are out there lobbying the Secular Coalition to say that so-called faith-based initiatives can't discriminate and proselytize because they're using federal funds, right? James Madison opposed, even when there was no federal money, he said, I will veto legislation that allows a church to carry out a government function because it gives them a government imprimatur, even though there wasn't a dime of federal money involved. He just said, no, that's too close of an entanglement between church and state. That's what the father of our nation's Constitution thought about these issues. But I've had this, again, it sounds funny, but I heard it recently when I was on this talk radio show, where they said, well, that's just, you know, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson. Who are those guys? There were lots of other founders. There were lots of other founding fathers, and so, you know, that they're just a minority view. I'm not making it up, but people assert that. But, okay, let's you know, broaden it and look around. Let's go to John Adams. And John Adams was probably the most religious of the early presidents. And here's what Adams said, that the United States Marx, quote, "the example of governments erected on the simple principle of nature, government founded, quote, on the natural authority of the people alone, without a pretense of miracle or mystery. And this is a great step and a point gained in the favor of the rights of mankind." John Adams. He also signed a treaty that was approved by his Secretary of State, unanimously approved by the U.S. Senate, that said the U.S. government, quote, "is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion." Not in any sense. And by the way, that specific language was approved by his predecessor, George Washington, the father of our country. So Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, these were brains and thinkers of the Enlightenment part of American history. And yeah, sometimes they were lightning rods because of that. In fact, lightning rods is sort of an apt analogy. True story, Ben Franklin, you guys remember, you know, from school, he invented the lightning rod. Clergy on both sides of the Atlantic condemned him because it was thwarting the will of God. If somebody got struck by lightning, it's because God was getting them for a sin. You're thwarting the will of God. That's literally what some of the folks in the clergy said. But that was a minority view. It was a view, it was out there, but it was a minority view. Thomas Jefferson, when he ran in 1800, almost all the clergy was openly hostile to Thomas Jefferson getting elected president of the United States of America. As we recall, he won. One of the reasons that helped him win, about 10 to 15% of Americans in 1800 were church-going citizens. 10 to 15%. It was a different kind of country at the sort of fruition of the Enlightenment era. Now, things did start to change, and we saw more of what we would now call fundamentalism on the rise, and some of these young, ambitious candidates didn't quite get the memo, you know, of modifying what they said. Here's one ambitious young politician who said, quote, "the Bible's not my book, nor Christianity my profession." That would be Abraham Lincoln, the savior of the Union. He never joined a church, ever. When he ran against Stephen Douglas for the U.S. Senate, and he was from Springfield, all 100% of the clergy in Springfield, Illinois, supported Stephen Douglas, not Abraham Lincoln. His law partner and his best friend said that Lincoln died an unbeliever. Now, I don't know whether Lincoln was a believer or not a believer, and it's not really my concern. What I do know is that if he were confronted with the things he himself said, he'd have trouble getting elected to Congress, much less president of the United States of America. Let's turn for a moment to the Abe Lincoln of American letters, Mark Twain. And in Huckleberry Finn, which Hemingway called the basis of all American literature thereafter, the central focus, the central conflict, is that Huck knows, because he's told in church, that it is a sin to help the runaway slave Jim, his friend. And Huck makes the decision to accept eternal burning and damnation and fire in order to help his friend, but he believes sincerely that that's what he is going to accept for himself, because the church teachings are very, very clear on this point. But also Mark Twain was sort of clear himself. He said, quote, "if there is a God, he is a malign thug." Mark Twain said, "I cannot see how a man of any large degree of humorous perception can ever be religious." Now, I'm not saying that everybody has to agree with Mark Twain in American society, but what I am saying is that we want Mark Twain included in American. We would sort of like this kind of mind to be included in American society. And one of the people who agreed that he should is Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy said, "America is where every man has the same right to attend or not attend the church of his choice. And no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference." Kennedy's policy is a little bit different than what we've seen in recent decades, right? I mean, where you see government funds going to religious schools which don't have to, in many cases, obey the laws that other schools have to obey. One example, you know, free of a lot of the laws that other schools have to obey, and one that was really free was the Golden Christian School, real example in Cleveland, Ohio. Their curriculum at this school consisted entirely of watching videos, and they got government funds. Your tax money at work once again. So for me anyway, and I hope for all of us, the answer is no to government funds for religious schools, just like Jack Kennedy said. But I also think we should say yes to reading the Bible in school. I'm all for it. I think we should read the Bible in school. Absolutely. Read the Quran in school. Also read the Constitution of the United States of America. Which of those documents evolves? And which evoke barbaric violence and vengeance? You know, America has to be made safe for these ideas like those of Einstein and Twain. And America has to be made safe for the politics of folks like Jefferson and Madison. So I hope we'll follow two big golden rules. Golden rule number one, do not to your neighbor what you would take ill from him. Sometimes you've heard something similar attributed to Jesus Christ. Who knows? But that quote comes from Pittacus, the Greek philosopher who wrote those words 5 centuries before Christ. A second golden rule is the Constitution of the United States of America, particularly Article 6, Section 3, which we should always remind people of, says federal officials shall be bound to support the Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. The beauty of our Constitution is that Madison designed it based on a theory of evolution. If you look at the Bible and the Quran, they reject evolution, but not just evolution in the scientific sense. They reject evolution in the humanistic sense. No matter what compassion or experience or new evidence or history bring to us as human beings to maybe take a new or different view, those documents remain locked in stone. That's the way it is. Blacks, women, gay people. Sorry, your application was received 2,000 years too late. Pity for you. Madison's genius was different because it was humble. It was a humble genius. He said, I know in 1789 that I don't know. I know that there's a justice out there that I'm not yet aware of, and I want to help with trying to create a mechanism that will help move us there. And so with Darwin and Einstein, I talk of them, you know, you heard, of course, we have, of the Book of Revelations. I say that Darwin and Einstein wrote the real books of Revelations. Real revelations. New ways of looking about how our universe and our world works. And just as dramatically, and just as importantly, this is what James Madison did, is he said, here's a new way. Let's reveal a new way of how humans might interact with one another. That's what we want to see. And you know, Einstein pulled it off and said, I'm going to show you that light bends. And he did. He showed that light bends. And I feel like Madison showed us that the light of justice also bends, that it's bending toward compassion and moving us in that direction. And it really is moving in our direction. You know, in the most recent polling, 7% of Americans who are 65 or older identify with a naturalistic worldview, some form of non-belief. Of people 30 and under, almost 4 times as many identify as some form of non-believer. Things are heading in our direction. The trends are headed our way. The religious right, though, has huge amounts of money, and they have tremendous lobbying power. What the Secular Coalition for America has is justice on our side, and the trends are headed in our direction. And this is one organization, because we're small, that your active leadership, your active involvement, getting involved with our action alerts, talking to your members of Congress, talking to your legislators, getting involved in our organization can really make a major difference in a historic movement. You know, President Jimmy Carter, a religious guy, since he left the White House, he said he's visited over 125 nations. And he said that in these nations, it's remarkable to him that John Lennon's song, Imagine, is treated by the people in these many different countries almost equally with their national anthems. So I think that Madison, a lawyer, and John Lennon, a poet, both came to care most about how human beings interact with each other, and in the hope that it would improve, that, you know, in the words of Aeschylus, that we would tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of the world. And Madison imagined a constitution that was this mechanism for moving us and helping us evolve closer and closer to a world of greater justice. And John Lennon's song, Imagine, constitutes this vision of this world. And with each passing decade, people are crying out more and more and with more and more passion to see that world come to fruition. But so far, frankly, I don't think our efforts have matched the nobility of this vision that these folks have laid out for us. So it does say, we got to remember it because it's part of our culture, that the scripture did say that God instructs Abraham to kill his son. And we should remember as part of history that the Incas brought their children to the mountains and drugged them and killed them. And I just hope we in this room will also remember these very real stories of Amiya White dying alone in that van, that will remember Jessica Crank, that will remember what happened right here in Wisconsin last year, and that we cannot sit silently while a modern Abraham is authorized by law to kill their child. That's what it is. Not in this century, not with our laws, and not under this Constitution. You know, the vicious McCarthy era foisted upon us the phrase, one nation under God. But what we really are is one nation under the Constitution. That's what we always have been. That was the original vision. That's what we need to be. And we in this room, we may not be the biggest group, but I think that we have the right on our side and we have the passion of justice on our side and that things are headed our way. And that I think the young people in this room, I believe that 20 years from now, you know, the young people next down the line will say, ah, only 25 or 30% were non-believers. We're 50 or 60% in our generation. And they're like, oh, sorry, old timer. And I look forward to that when I'm a geezer, you know, that we're going to see that day and it's going to happen. But it's not going to be out of hostility or anger. It's out of compassion, that this is a compassionate, deeply compassionate worldview. And that if we go out and advocate on the issues and say to our friends who are believers, say, hey, you got to agree with us about what happened to Amiya White. You got to agree with us about what happened to Jessica Crank and Madeline. So you can join us doing what's moral. If you don't want to be moral, you don't have to join us. But we would actually believe that doing the moral thing is the right thing. And you religious folks are welcome to join us. And I think we need to take that moral high ground because we have it. And I think sometimes we let ourselves become solely engaged with debates about whether God exists or doesn't exist. Frankly, I don't think he exists, but what I care most about is my fellow human beings and how we can make their lives better. And we have to be the leaders in that effort. I think we're going to be. I think we're going to do it, and I think this next 10 years is going to be one of the most exciting decades that we're ever going to see. And I really ask your help and need your help with that cause. I'm going to devote my life to this, and I'd like each one of us in this room to devote part of our lives to it. So thanks a lot, and I'm happy to answer questions. And to me, this is my favorite part, is, you know, question and answer, although I see all the food and wine there. So, you know, if you guys want to get food and wine, I hear you, because I might follow that trend. Yeah.
A concern that I have, regardless of what your opinion is on whether or not immigration from south of the border is legal or illegal or good or bad, but a concern that I have that very few other people have voiced is that I'm concerned that they might bring a religion to this country which I would fear if it were to become the majoritarian religion. Mm. There have been instances, like one in Wisconsin, where an archbishop in La Crosse was telling legislators of the state how they were supposed to vote on certain legislation. And I'm afraid that if...
And this bishop was someone from the third... from someplace else? Or what? I wasn't sure.
He was bishop of La Crosse.
City. Right, but... Okay.
No, bishop of St. Louis. Archbishop of St. Louis.
Okay, yeah.
That too.
Yeah, you were talking about the immigrants, though.
Immigrant.
When I was trying to.
Is he an immigrant?
No, but I'm saying that by terms of statistics or demography, that they would be bringing in a religion that has the potential to become majoritarian.
Well, I was talking, and I'd recommend to you some reading. There's Professor Avalos, who I had a great time in Iowa before I came here, and I met a professor at Iowa State who's a real expert. He was born in Mexico, and actually was a Pentecostal for his childhood. And went to Harvard and wrote a number of books, and is a non-believer at this stage, and really interesting guy to talk to. Has more books than my father. I'd never met anybody who had more books than my father till talking to this guy. And interestingly, he does talk about the trends, the demographic trends regarding religion in Latin nations and in third world nations. And then in Latin nations, traditionally, of course, Catholic Church was predominant, but that the fundamentalist and evangelical churches have made tremendous inroads in that part of the world, and that he believes that some of the Latin nations will be majority fundamentalist of some form or another over the coming decades. So, I mean, you do raise a demographic point, and I'm not sure I know the answer. I do think what we have to do is, one, I try to be respectful of, even though I couldn't disagree more with fundamentalist viewpoints, I try to treat every person individually with respect and not categorize them in various groups or try to avoid that. But I do think we need to speak for science. One area that we're talking about now is Secular Coalition. We actually haven't made a decision on this policy yet, but right now, sadly, even with the Obama administration, there are policies in place for foreign aid that still allow for the old, let's forget about talking about condoms, and other policies that don't make any scientific sense but make sense because of pressure from religious groups. And I think the most we can do, we can't change immigration and probably shouldn't, but what we might be able to do is speak out for appropriate separation of church and state policies in our foreign affairs as well, and in aid to foreign nations as well. And I also think, and this again goes a little bit beyond the mission of Secular Coalition for America, that a scientific view, like those of you who are involved in skeptic organizations, is really important. And to the extent that we invest less in war and invest more in science advancement, better for all the world, and hopefully if those investments are somewhat to the benefit of third world nations, that we can help tamp down the kind of trend that I think you're expressing concern regarding. Yeah, and maybe if anybody else wants to help me figure out who's in line. I'm not good at that, but yeah.
Well, I'd like to first of all congratulate you on your political perspicacity coming to a city named for James Madison.
There we go, all right.
And saying good words about James Madison.
Yeah.
I'd like to recommend to all my friends here that they carry their own copy of the Citizens User Manual with them wherever you go.
Right, there you go.
It always helps to be able to pull out what chapter and verse to the people for whom chapter and verse has significant meaning.
Especially the police.
What's
that? Yeah. This is called the Declaration of Independence and Constitution of the United States of America. And it comes in handy wallet size.
Little red book.
I recommend it. And it's my firm belief that the words of James Madison are the greatest gift America has made to the entire civilization.
Hear, hear.
Because this is the country that invented separation of church and state.
Right.
And James Madison is the guy that wrote it up. But what I really wanted to ask was, yep. I don't know to what extent you're continuing to keep in touch with your roots in Maine, but I am concerned about the what's going on with the gay marriage situation.
Yep.
Could you handicap that situation for us?
I really couldn't. Well, I can, but it's purely speculative. I've been spending my time in D.C., and I'm not really deeply enmeshed in the mechanics of that campaign. My own instinct, which is maybe too optimistic, is that I've seen that corner already turn in our state. I mean, we're not Alabama. For example, in 1992, 3, 4, the years melt together when you get old, I ran for state senate in Bangor. And there was a fellow, a gay man, who came to me and said, will you march in the gay pride parade in Bangor? And I don't know how much people here know Maine, but Portland's kind of the hip town, lots of gay people, it's different. Bangor's, you know, at least at that time, was not quite there yet for that. And so it was something where people said, no, don't do that. That's crossing a line that might harm you in your political career and all of that. And it was interesting question. And I ended up marching in the parade. And as it turned out, I was the only elected official who marched in that parade in the entire congressional district. And now, just to contrast that, one, the guy who asked me to march in the parade is my successor in the House district. He's elected to the legislature. And secondly, now the politicians, and I'm including a lot of Republicans now, are saying, get out of the way, I'm getting to that gay pride parade, you know, because it's a constituency that has votes. So there's been a change in terms of the environment in a dramatic way in whatever, 12, 15 years. And so they may succeed, and certainly the religious right has the dough and all of that, but I just feel like the demographic trends, it is similar to our movement. I view us as sort of in 1989, if you will, in analogous to the equal rights for gay citizens, that we've got a lot of challenges, but I'm very optimistic because I feel like, again, the demographic data really is very optimistic for us, as it was there. Because again, if you look at the data on the issue of equal rights for gay people, the younger people are, the more accepting they are of that issue. You know, I'm proud of, like, my father's 82 years old and he's for equal rights for gay people. But that's, you know, the trend is definitely where younger people are more accepting. And I think the same is true with non-theism. So that's my prediction on the issue. And I just threw in optimism about non-theism while I was at it. So. Yeah.
Before I ask my question, one, the leader of Chile is, I discovered today, is an atheist or an agnostic. So
is that right?
South of the border does good not necessarily mean.
Oh, the woman prime minister.
Look it up. Just cut it out of the site today for the month. Michelle.
Yeah.
Bachelet.
Yeah. Bachelet. I remember that and then forgot it. Thank you.
Chile. Amongst five. Denmark. Sweden, too. Yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you mentioned atheists, your dad being over 82, and gay, because those are the three groups that most people won't vote for, with atheists leading and beyond the 50.
Won't vote for people over 82?
Yeah, and nobody over 72. But that's, I'll show you the article later.
Okay,
the thing I wanted to mention in the separating church from state, in the area of substance abuse, our government has, in the 50s, financed the making of this Father Martin Chalk Talks, the AA-promoting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And our government has web pages and pamphlets that always tell you to go to AA, and now they've added, or another support group, but they never mention what the other one is. At the end somewhere there, you can usually find one of them, but you can't find the whole list together, and it sure as heck, I don't know how, but somehow they always manage to screw up the address or the phone number or the website of one or three of them.
Yeah.
Okay. There are three groups that are secular. SOS, which is basically the 12 steps, but they took their crayon and crossed God out.
Yeah.
Something called Life Ring, and the one that I am the board of, Smart Recovery, Self-Management Recovery Training.
Right.
And I'm wondering, is your group interested in helping us, because we're starting, you know, we got a 15-year leap, they have 75, they have 110 people in an office building in downtown New York, we have 1.5 paid employees in Mentor, Ohio. We have 500 groups around the world.
You're directly involved in this.
I'm on their board of directors.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm the publicity chair, so.
Yeah.
Community relations.
Okay. Here we go.
Community relations.
Talk away. It's the microphone's right there.
Oh.
How
do we get our government to promote us to the extent that they promote the 12 steps, 9 courts have decided they are truly religious. It's not spiritual to ask God to take away your character defects.
If
you read the 12 steps, it's kind of like reading the Ten Commandments.
Right.
I am the Lord thy God, you'll have no other gods before me.
Right.
I mean, it's not a moral, ethical document.
Right. Well, speaking of promotion, I hope everyone here will go to secular.org, which is our website. So that's secular.org. And on there, we have a position paper on faith-based initiatives. And what we've been working on, I got to say, most recently and with focus, is the faith-based initiatives as created, or I shouldn't say created, but changed under the Bush administration, where there is permission to proselytize effectively, or not regulation of proselytization, and discrimination, like I've described, or as they would term it, co-religionist requirements. So we actively oppose that. We are, although pleased with President Obama's stand regarding including non-theists in prominent speeches, the inaugural, his speech in Cairo and elsewhere. Unfortunately, though, the president has yet to follow through on his own statement in Zanesville, Ohio, that he would prohibit discrimination and proselytizing with an executive order. And by the way, he doesn't need Congress. He could just sign it, stroke of a pen, and he could rescind that policy. And unfortunately, the president has not followed through on that, and we're actively advocating. So our position, our principle, is, you know, the Madisonian absolutist separation of church and state, and what you described with AA. I got to admit, in our office, we haven't discussed it that much lately, but I'd be happy to, you know, be educated about what the statutes and regs are and see what we can do. I am always looking. I mean, I've only been in this job for a couple months, 3 months from, but what I'm really looking to do is to work with people like you so you come up with these ideas and we say, what A is wrong about separation of church and state issues, or that can help raise the prominence and acceptance of non-theistic people. But also, too, I want to work on strategy. So we say, what are the issues that will be perhaps persuasive to the middle? So there's lots of people out there. I have faith. There's lots of people out there. Sorry for the use of the word faith, everyone. But I believe and think I'm correct that there's a lot of folks out there who may even identify as religious who, when they hear the issues like the ones regarding Amiya White or regarding Madeline here in Wisconsin, will say, I'm with you guys. I'm with the Secular Coalition for America on that call. And that will help us bring people from the middle into our efforts. And so this is another issue where if we can make that case, I'm happy and eager to do it. So, yeah, www.secular.org. Lots of position papers.
So I have a question about the Secular Coalition for America.
Yes.
So I believe that as human beings, whatever your religious belief, we have 99% of everything we have. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be human nature to pick on the things that we don't agree on.
Right.
Like it was like you said, is there a God or is there not a God? It's not even really relevant to a lot of issues that we face today. So one of the big missed opportunities in human relations is getting people to work together on things. So towards that end, I have kind of an issue with someone on the board. Is it, do you call it the board or the people?
Our board?
Yeah. So,
well, and just to... Well, I'll let you finish your statement.
Okay.
I'll clarify what our structure is.
Okay, Christopher Hitchens.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Our advisory board. He's very amusing.
Yep.
I agree with a lot of things that he says, but I believe he's very divisive.
Mm-hmm.
And I question why he's associated with the Secular Coalition for America, since we're trying to bring people together to agree on issues. So I was wondering if you could talk to that for a minute.
No. No. actually, seriously, no, in one sense, that I was hired 2-3 months ago, and Mr. Hitchens was already a member of our advisory board, and I am not knowledgeable as to exactly what the situation was. I will say he has collated a lot of thinking that is meaningful to this effort. And I just finished, I gotta say, The Portable Atheist. And it was very interesting and educational for me. I mean, I did inherit the wind. I sort of said, yep, I'm an agnostic. And then I went into politics and didn't think about it that much. You know, I was for separation of church and state. But I didn't know there was a secular coalition until not very long ago. I didn't know about this whole movement. It was just my own personal opinion. And so I don't know... what the specifics were in deciding to have him, but I do think he brought tremendous information that popularizes a lot of information that guys like me did not have. I'm sure there are people in this room who are active non-theists, organizational non-theists for decades. That's not me. And so that kind of education, and when people go to our website and go, maybe I'm interested, and they see Chris Hitchens, you know, then they can go look up things and find things to read. Does he say provocative stuff? He says stuff on Iraq that, again, we are the Secular Coalition for America, and we do not have opinions beyond what our organization has made an official decision to take a stance regarding. But I can tell you, Sean Faircloth, me, as an individual, I have a different opinion than he does about Iraq pretty strongly. But we accept all comers. I mean, we, in fact, are actively looking to work with libertarians, for example, of whom, you know, there's a lot of non-theists. So I guess my answer, I don't know what the official answer is, I'll be honest, is my answer is it's a big tent. He is a witty guy and a provocative thinker. Sometimes he says things that are very, to say the least, provocative. But he's a great collator and articulator of information. So that's my view of it. But I think you raise a good point. And frankly, I think, I got to say, it's partly my job, maybe partly your job. But for me, I think you put your finger on, I wouldn't say necessarily Christopher Hitchens. I'd say in the movement that there's a tendency to have sort of that debating society tone. I mean, I believe, I'm just a lawyer, I'm not a biologist, but I'm convinced that Darwin was right and that creationism is wrong. But I'm just a lawyer, and I'm not qualified to go and make arguments on that like, you know, others are. But I, as a politician, and as someone looking at how you might persuade people who are in the middle, I sometimes question our own strategy, not just with regard to one person, but globally as a movement, that there's sometimes, not with everybody, but sometimes the tendency to sort of come across like, you know, I know that evolution is right, and I know you're stupid for not thinking so. And that it kind of... and that may be, on an intellectual basis, entirely, you know, a reasonable way of concluding, but I don't think it's a reasonable way of persuading the middle. I don't think it's a reasonable way of having us win the policy debate. And that's what Secular Coalition for America is about. You know, in our 10-member organizations, we have the American atheists who proudly, they describe themselves. One fellow who was on their board, I think, said to me, "We're the Marines, you know, for, you know, we're out there going, yeah, you know, we take them on." And then you have, we were talking about the ethical culturalists, who specifically describe themselves as religious, expressly as religious, even though they're non-theistic, they describe themselves as religious. There's sometimes tension between various members of our group, but we all work together on the policy end. And what I hope I bring to it, or try to bring to it, is that I'm looking to this optimistic vision that raises policy issues and says, let's all join together on these policy issues, and come on, religious people, and that they maybe come with us, and if they don't, they look the worse for it, because we're doing the right thing. And that, I think, is that strategy, is something I want to work with you on, and everyone here on, so that we do win the day, and persuade the middle. No, I mean, I did. If somebody asked me, you know, that was fine. But here's what people, because I've gotten this question, so, and then you think back and say, what did people know and when did they know it? Right. Certainly the elected officials knew that I was a non-believer. They had a prayer where, you know, like a lot of legislatures, they open with some prayer, or whatever you want to call it, and usually it's Christian prayer. Sometimes they bring in a rabbi, or, you know, I think once we had somebody Hindu they found. But one day, as often happens in state legislatures, we're here in Madison, so probably some of you are familiar with the legislative process, but the way it is in Maine and a lot of states is, you know, you start out slow, and then it's, oh my God, we got to finish by this date, and things start going crazy. So the early part of the session, they have all these ministers planned out, and they're, you know, constituents that people want to please. By the end of the session, it's like, go up there and do a prayer, quick! And so they got me, and I'm like, okay, I'll give you a prayer. And so I did, I quoted Free Thinkers by Susan Jacoby and Walt Whitman. It was totally secular and had a blast, and actually got some, most people were fine with it, but some of my, especially some of the folks on the other side, were writing notes, hey, that wasn't a real prayer. You got to do a real prayer.
Yeah. What do you know about The Family, Jeff Charlotte's book?
Right.
About, you know, National Day of Prayer. And then the other one is, how do you see the Supreme Court now? We have five Catholics. Was it six now?
Mm-hmm. They multiply like rabbits.
Hey, I went to Notre Dame. Let's watch it there.
Her acceptance speech, she asked for, you know, help from a higher power.
Did she? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's see. Well, let me take that one first. My favorite United States Supreme Court justice of all time is someone I met in law school, William Brennan, who was a devout practicing Catholic. And there was nobody ever as good at separating church and state as William Brennan. I mean, he was actually, in the modern times, two Catholics, Jack Kennedy was rock solid separation of church and state, and so was William Brennan. So I don't necessarily say because you're religious, we're, you know, going to have an issue with them because of that on separation of church and state issues. Having said that, clearly the justices that we're seeing now, and I don't know if it's necessarily because they're Catholic as because of part one of your question, is that there has been an orchestrated effort starting with groups like the Family and the C Street Group that really looked for a specific type of nominee for the Supreme Court where they knew they were getting what they wanted to get in terms of right-wing policies. I view Chief Justice Roberts as a right-wing political activist who happens to have a robe on. He is not objective. He is not someone who supports original intent. And I think he undermines the Constitution at most every turn. I don't necessarily say that's because he's Catholic. I think it's because he is a committed right-wing ideologue. And it does relate to the C Street part of your question. And for those who you know are not familiar, probably most of you are, the book The Family and the C Street Group, it is a very disturbing expose on the origins of this far-right religious belief. I mean, some of the things are hard to believe, yet some are on tape where they talk about positive analogies between Christ, their movement, and Hitler. Mm-hmm. Pretty scary and jarring conduct. And more ominously, the relationship between these leaders, not even in our time, but back in the 60s, for example, where the dictator of Indonesia, who I don't think really cared that much about Christianity, but liked being with right-wing ideologues who would help him in the U.S. government, and they were perfectly willing to help with a kind of vicious dictatorial power. And unfortunately, President Gerald Ford was a participant in this group back in those days, was way too supportive of what happened in Indonesia, where, by the way, because I guess, I don't know, is it because they have dark skin, or I don't know what the reason is, something in an estimate of 500,000 people or more died in the what was essentially a genocide under that Indonesian dictatorship.
Communists,
whatever it was. I mean, it's almost like a trivia question, but it's staggering, the number of people that that government killed, and most Americans are completely unaware how much involved we were in that killing. And it is partly, I wouldn't say entirely, but partly due to the rise of this very secretive Christian right organization that authorizes right-wing dictators and gives them a stamp of approval for these horrific kind of activities. So I think the best thing we can do, and I hope at Secular Coalition, is to talk about it more. One of the things that I try to do in some of our press statements and releases is to add some of this information. Because a lot of times, because we're good and academic, and we write about, yes or no on issue A or B or C, but I want to start throwing in factual things, but say, yes, from the senator who also attended the C Street group, where they, counsel each other about how to have affairs because it's okay with Christ or something. Bizarre and strange. You ever heard this one? I won't go into the sex stuff, but it's pretty amazing.
All the sex scandals, all those people want.
Yeah, Senator Enzin, who was counseled about his sex scandal at this C Street location.
Ron Sanford from South Carolina, the governor.
Right. It sounds wacky, but part of the philosophy, even though these are people who publicly, make a very big deal about sexual prudery and sexual propriety, it's almost part of the doctrine of the organization that they can do what they want,
right,
sexually, politically, any other way, in ways that clearly contradict what they're saying in public.
But they believe the Ten Commandments is for the little people. They have
the max.
Right.
Yeah, they're of a higher level.
Right, and it's a strangely expressed part of the doctrine where they talk about those that in power are anointed and those that in power can act. And they actually sometimes...
If this was a horror film.
Accurate. You're right. Sometimes accurately they'll refer to Scripture, and talk about Scripture where, some Old Testament leader lays waste.
That's what I don't understand.
Because they're a church.
They're worth $500 million. And
right. Well, one of the things that I want to... work on, and I'm sort of interesting with the microphone on here, but because this is sort of an internal strategic issue, but one of the things that I'd like to look at anyway is a lot of times when I come to speaking engagements like this, people say, take away their tax-exempt status. But then the response from the other side, of course, is what? Well, nonprofits, secular nonprofits, are also tax exempt. But what is not spoken of, and what I think maybe we need to look into more, is that above and beyond the tax exempt status, there are additional advantages to being a religious organization about your IRS filings, about information you don't need to provide. And I think we need to start going after some of those issues and showing the contrast. And obviously, from my perspective, all churches should be providing information. But I think even, not to oversimplify, but the Joe Sixpack and Soccer Mom, you know, would say, the Scientologists, they don't give out their records, and that hopefully people in the middle at the mall go, that doesn't sound right and sounds scary, and that we want to talk about those issues, because whether you think that, you know, the Catholic Church is equal or not equal to Scientology, in any case, financial abuses are something that I hope the average citizen would care about.
So I think that let's give Sean again a round of applause. Thank you.